Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Lauren Litton, the host of Spotlight on Youth. Spotlight on Youth is a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. It is a project of Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. And to indicate you have a question, press the number 1 on your telephone keypad and you'll be placed in the queue. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose questions there. In 1967, the United States Supreme Court held that youth have due process rights in juvenile court proceedings. Today, most people assume that when a child is involved in the juvenile justice system, that he or she is automatically represented by an attorney and that representation is meaningful. Unfortunately, that is not the case, and the potential long-term impact of that void for children is great. Instead, studies have revealed that across the country, children are unable to obtain attorneys at early and post-dispositional stages of delinquency proceedings. There's a high rate of waiver of counsel, and that many youth do not have access to attorneys that are sufficiently resourced to provide zealous representation. Numerous states and national organizations have been working to bring greater understanding to the issue and to remedy the situation. Today, Arthur Bowie and Tim Curry join us to examine why representation is critical in juvenile court and when counsel should be appointed in the process. We will also be exploring what does quality and zealous representation look like, what is the judge's role in ensuring a youth understands his or her due process rights, and how can we help reduce the number of youth that waive their right to counsel. So Arthur and Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me do some brief introductions of you. Arthur Bowie is a supervising assistant public defender for the Research and Training Division for the Sacramento County Public Defender's Office. In this capacity, he is responsible for the day-to-day research, training, and development of a staff of more than 100 lawyers, including adult and juvenile defenders. Arthur is also a part-time instructor at California State University, Sacramento, in the Criminal Justice Department and represents indigent children on appeal as a panel attorney with the Central California Appellate Program. His work in the area of juvenile competency led to the first published appellate opinion in the United States recognizing developmental immaturity as a non-statutory basis to find a child not competent to stand trial, and it also held that a child did not have to have a mental disorder or be developmentally disabled to be found not competent to stand trial. He was named Attorney of the Year by the Pacific Juvenile Defenders Center for Excellence in Juvenile Delinquency Litigation, and the California Public Defenders Association awarded his division special recognition for excellence in juvenile law for distinguishing itself in impact litigation and for working collaboratively, positively, and proactively to meet the needs of children with special education and mental health needs. Tim Curry is a managing attorney at the National Juvenile Defender Center, also known as NJDC, where he supervises the legal staff and oversees the breadth of work produced by the organization, including defender training and curriculum development. Most recently, his work has centered on issues of access to counsel, the role of defense counsel in juvenile court, and defender ethics. Previously, Tim worked as a juvenile and adult defense attorney in Washington, D.C. He also served as a supervising attorney adjunct professor at the D.C. Law Students and Court Program and as an eBarrett Pretty Man Postgraduate Fellow at Georgetown University Law Center. In those positions, he taught law clinic seminars and supervised the practice of third-year law students who represent clients in local court. Before earning his law degree, Tim worked with various humanitarian relief organizations in West Africa and as a television and print journalist. Tim holds his master's in law and advocacy from Georgetown University Law Center, a Juris Doctor from American University's Washington College of Law, and a bachelor's in broadcast journalism from Syracuse University. So, Tim, I reference In re Galt, which was the U.S. Supreme Court case that began to solidify that youth have constitutional rights in juvenile court delinquency matters. Maybe to help set the stage for today's conversation, you can briefly summarize that landmark decision and the due process rights it guaranteed for youth.
Sure. I think, as you said, Gault was decided in 1967. But in order to kind of understand where we are in 1967, it's important to look a little bit further back to what the status of juvenile court was prior to that decision. The first juvenile court was created in 1899 in Illinois. Prior to that, any kids who were prosecuted in the adult system and subject to adult penalties in adult jails. And the idea behind this 1899 court in Illinois was that, you know, kids are different than adults and they are less culpable in many ways. And the idea for the courts was to probably get these kids services and direction to become to grow into develop into productive members of society. That idea caught on and spread across the country. By 1967, most states had a juvenile court specific to kids. Now, the idea behind those initial juvenile courts was a good one, and it was founded on the idea that kids are different. But the way the courts approached that, it was kind of this parens patriae idea, this idea that the courts were kind of parentally responsible for kids and correcting them. And in that sense, they acted like parents in a lot of ways, and the ideas of due process didn't really play out in juvenile courts. So fast forward to 1967, and the facts of Gerald Gault's case kind of illustrate what was going wrong with that with the process. Gerald was 15 when he and his friend were arrested for allegedly making a lewd telephone call to a neighbor. Now, Gerald was detained overnight without anyone notifying his family. The family eventually learned about it, but not through anyone in the system. And then he went before the judge the next day. His mother did show up, but there was a kind of perfunctory hearing. It was Gerald, the probation officer, a judge, and his mother, and they kind of discussed what happened. The alleged victim, in this case the neighbor, wasn't there, even despite Gerald's mother's request of why she wasn't there, what to get her side of the story. Everything came through the probation officer. Gerald had no lawyer, and no lawyer other than potentially the judge was present in the room. At the end of the meeting, the judge decided he needed some time to think about it and sent Gerald back to detention. A couple days later, without any decision, they released Gerald and told him to come back to the judge in a couple days for a hearing. When they came back, again, there was the neighbor was not there. And all these meetings are happening not in a courtroom, but in the judge's chambers. And so there was no alleged victim, no lawyers, no transcript was ever taken, and there was kind of dispute of what happened in these meetings, what Gerald admitted to and what he didn't admit to. But ultimately, the judge found Gerald guilty of what eventually they decided was making lewd telephone calls. And he sentenced him to be committed to the state up until his 21st birthday. Now, remember, Gerald was 15 at the time, so this is a sentence of potentially 6 years. Now, had Gerald been an adult under that same circumstance, his maximum fine would have been $50, and his maximum jail time would have been 2 months. But Gerald, being a child, was subject to long-term penalties and had absolutely no legal representation. So the case made its way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said that this isn't right, that kids have rights under the Constitution just like adults. Now, the court found that in order to be in line with due process in the circumstances of this case, that all children have the right to notice of the charges against them sufficiently in advance to present a defense. In this case, Gerald, no one told Gerald what he was being charged with other than the fact that he had made some phone calls and people were upset, and it took a while for them to figure out exactly what he was guilty of, per se. The Supreme Court also said that kids have a privilege against self-incrimination just like adults, that regardless of whether these courts were civil and or criminal, the fact that a kid might lose his liberty meant that he was entitled to the same protections that adults were. So they don't have to testify against themselves. They don't have to be forced to make confessions, and so on. The court also said that kids have a right to confront and cross-examine witnesses against them, and that was one of the major sticking points in this case. Gerald's mother brought it up at least once, if not twice. that we never heard from the neighbor in this case. And finally, in order to guard all of these rights, the court said, kids have a right to the assistance of counsel, just like adults in a criminal court, and that a juvenile needs the assistance of counsel to, quote, cope with the facts, to insist upon regularity in the proceedings, and to ascertain whether he has a defense, and to prepare and submit it. The child requires the guiding hand of counsel at every step in the proceedings against him. So this was the first time that we had major due process rights given to a child. Now, subsequent cases have kind of expanded on the rights that kids have in juvenile court as in relation to the same rights in adult court. In the case of In re Winship, 1970, the court held that to find a child guilty or involved of a crime, it had to be held, they had to be held to the same standard of proof that an adult would in a criminal case, and that's the proof beyond reasonable doubt. Prior to that, in juvenile courts, a lot of times they're using the civil standard of preponderance of evidence. And then in 1975, there was a case called Breed v. Jones that said the double jeopardy protections, that is, that you can't be prosecuted twice for the same crime, extend to children as well in the delinquency system. Now, not all due process that adults have is attributable to kids as well. In 1971, the Supreme Court, in a case called McKeever v. Pennsylvania, said that children do not have the right constitutionally to a jury trial. That juries were not necessary to ensure fair proceedings. Now, some states do allow juveniles to have jury trials, but that's either a state constitution or a state statute that allows that. It's not the federal constitution. So that's a general wrap-up of kind of where due process was, how Galt was involved, and kind of how it's taken us into the present day.
Thank you. Arthur, do you have anything you want to add to that?
No, not really. I mean, that's pretty much sums it up. The one thing, though, that Tim alluded to is you begin to see this evolution with respect to rights of children in delinquency or criminal settings, and you're even starting to see some of that evolution to begin to take place today. Just recently, you're talking about right to counsel and with respect to kids in settings being confronted by law enforcement, the Supreme Court recognized that, you know, kids are different than adults. I mean, there's critical stages in the process where a child is going to respond differently than an adult, and one of those stages is at the arrest stage. So kids can, at that point, begin to ask for counsel, just like an adult. Adults get the kids and adults get the same right to, as Tim alluded to, not respond to questioning by law enforcement or authority, and can have right to counsel at that stage, and going on into the process. So you're beginning to, again, maybe see some evolution, even now recognizing that kids are entitled to a little more protection in some of these settings.
Great, thank you. And I know people are probably thinking, so why are we even discussing this, right? If the Supreme Court back in 1967 said children should have the right at every step of the process, but maybe you can talk about why it's really important that youth have representation, at what stages, and really what has been the interpretation of that in the United States.
Yeah, the courts have concluded that constitutionally you have a right to counsel at any critical stage of the criminal process. And like I was mentioning earlier, that goes all the way back to the point of arrest. When you hear those Miranda rights, what we've become accustomed to calling them, right to remain silent, right to a lawyer before or during questioning. So it starts there. And when children are brought into the juvenile justice process, it's a criminal court. It is what we refer to as a quasi-criminal court. There are various stages within that process that it's important that you have counsel. At the very beginning, Tim talked about notice of the charges. Well, someone needs to be able to explain what those charges are. Now, the court will read those charges, but it's the lawyer that actually, in most cases, that will explain to the child what those charges are and what the prosecutor has to prove to find them guilty or responsible for the charges. Then you have the right to, in at least in juvenile court, not to be detained. So there's a presumption that if you're brought into court, you're not going to be put in juvenile hall. But there are times when the prosecution will say, well, you know, we want this child detained because this is a serious case. So someone needs to be able to represent to the court why the child should not be detained, or put the prosecution at task to show what those reasons are why this child needs to be detained in a juvenile hall. So the attorney's job is, in most cases, to investigate that process or investigate the facts and circumstances and deliver to the court arguments as to why the child shouldn't be detained. And then the process continues on into, in some cases, settlement conferences, in some cases, trial. But at every one of those stages, it's important that the child has adequate representation to make sure that the process is fair, complete, and just, and that he's able to put on a proper defense in his case.
And I think part of the problem with that, those are the rights, and that's what kids need, the adequate representation. But systems just aren't set up today to provide that kind of assistance. And I think that's where a lot of the problem is. When we talk about kids being able to get a lawyer or entitled to a lawyer when they're being questioned by police, the lawyer's not there when that right is being supposedly offered in a Miranda advisement. So unless a child is strong-willed enough to assert that right and say, no, you need to get me a lawyer, then the questioning is going to continue. There's no lawyer there to protect that child. The child has to assert his right under various Supreme Court kind of rulings. And so if the system isn't set up to provide it easily, often that the exercise of that right is really not possible. And if it is, if the child is capable of asserting that right well enough, then it just they hold the child over until he or she's going to go to court. And the same thing with what Arthur was referring to under these detention determinations. If a child is being detained by police, he has to come in to courts within 48 hours, 72 hours, depending on the jurisdiction, their detention has to be revisited by a judge and to see if there's something, if they should be detained while charges are filed. Now, lots of systems aren't set up to provide them with attorneys at that stage either. Now, a child and his parents can force the issue and say, we need a lawyer to help us with this. But in lots of jurisdictions, you're going to see that prosecutors are talking to children and their families before there's any lawyer available and discussing plea agreements and things like that. And so the system, though, there is this idea that you should have a lawyer in many jurisdictions. It's just not set up to accommodate that. And then the only way to get that is for kids who are already saying don't have the same, fortitude as some adults and need a special guiding hand of counsel are being forced to step up and require it. And I think that's part of the problem.
Mm-hmm. And so I think what we're saying is that kids are also being sent to detention before they've had any chance to speak to counsel. And then another area where representation has been difficult is post-disposition. So I don't know if there have been any studies across the country about representation at different stages and how many courts are providing attorneys up front and some of the impact of that and also post-disposition that you can share.
One of the things, I'm in California, so I can kind of speak to what happens here, which is, after talking to Tim, it's really enlightening to what's happening in the rest of the country. We established some rules of court to ensure that a child has adequate counsel throughout the process. Again, it's a rule of court. It's not necessarily statutory or driven by the legislature. The legislature in California did provide for appointment of counsel for children from the point of detention or the point of arraignment throughout the process up through the first level of appeal. So they have a right to appointed counsel, and we pretty much do that from the outset. With respect to post-disposition work, which you asked about, it was just recently that we got a rule of court that allowed for or provided for attorneys to be continued appointed on the case through post-disposition. Now, again, that's a rule of court. It's kind of has the effect of a good suggestion to different jurisdictions. And depending on where you practice, at least in California, which is probably throughout the nation, when you have these types of rules, you may get adequate representation. You may not get any representation on post-dispositional issues. We have kids that, for instance, that are put in placement or removed from the home and put in group homes. We have kids that are put in state facilities that require adequate require services after they've been put into placement or put into a state facility, because there's different reporting that goes on from these facilities back to the court to indicate how the kids are doing in the placement or how they're doing in the state facility. Well, someone has to make those arguments on the kids' behalf in court, because they generally don't bring those kids back. We also have kids that are getting services in the community that sometimes have to be shepherded through. For instance, we have kids that have school issues, special education issues, where we can continue to work with them after the case is over while they're on probation to ensure that some of those things get taken care of, so they can fulfill the orders of the court. So, I mean, we've been fortunate here in California at least to have our judicial counsel to say, you know, this is a good idea. The fight is to get the various jurisdictions to buy into it and provide those services.
Yeah, and I think Arthur hit it on the head, and when it is going to vary by state. You know, there's this idea that at critical junctures you're entitled to the right to counsel, but there's not a complete commonality on what those critical junctures are in every state. Many states do not provide for post-disposition representation. The idea that you could have a lawyer if you're on a probation revocation in a probation revocation situation, or you're confined to a state institution and you have issues with your condition of confinement, the ideas behind that are that you may be entitled to a lawyer, but there's usually not a system set up for you to access that lawyer. Some states recognize that post-disposition work is part and parcel of the entire juvenile court representation, and they may even have statutes or court rules that say that, but even in many jurisdictions when that's the case, there's no system set up for paying for lawyers to do those things, and therefore it just doesn't get done. And so there is a critical gap, especially in post-disposition work. And when we talk about post-disposition work, it's kind of a term of art. I mean, it could be anything from the appellate process all the way through those little things I was talking about, the revocation of probation or parole, conditions of confinement, problems if you're on probation, not even revocation, but just increase in levels of responsibility or restriction. And so there's a whole host of advocacy that can be done in protecting children and their rights during those stages that's just falling by the wayside in many places.
Well, and before, I know we do want to get to talking about some standards of practice and how jurisdictions can be filling these gaps. So I want to get to something called the waiver of counsel. We've been talking about appointment of counsel, but another issue is waiver of counsel. I know in Ohio, in July 2012, our Supreme Court Juvenile Rule 3 went into effect, and that the goal of that rule was to reduce waiver of counsel. The rule mandates representation for youth in several circumstances and under another set of circumstances, ensures that youth understand their right to counsel, including appreciating any decision to waive that right by consulting with an attorney first and active court inquiry. It took 6 years to approve that rule. So why is this such a hotly debated issue? Can you clarify what is waiver of counsel? What is the problems with it?
Sure. The idea of waiver of counsel is that when a child is entitled to counsel, just like any right in the constitutional system, any individual is able to waive that right, to give it up. And so if the child does not want the lawyer and says to the court that they don't want the lawyer, that's considered a waiver of counsel. So when we were talking about the detention situations, like sometimes they will be advised, you have a right to a lawyer, but if the child doesn't say, yes, I want one, or actively pursue that, it's taken as a waiver in some circumstances. And so children go through initial negotiations with prosecutors about pleas. They go through detention hearings to determine where they're going to sleep even before charges are filed, and they don't have lawyers, and it's okay if it's been deemed that the child has waived counsel. And I think that's the problem, is even for adults, a lot of these decisions are very difficult to make. And when we're talking about children who have a completely different developmental and cognitive ability to understand a court process, it's absolutely imperative that they have someone there that knows the system, can counsel them in developmentally appropriate ways on what their rights are, what's going on with their situation, what the consequences of each of their decisions is going to be, and helping them to make informed decisions. Now, lots of systems, the reality is lots of systems see defense lawyers as getting in the way, slowing things down, that you can ask for a lawyer, but we're going to have to pass your case, we're going to have to get you screened to see if you qualify for a free attorney or not. Lots of processes that slow things down when everyone around them, from intake workers to prosecutors to sometimes even judges, is saying, but if you'd like to just get it taken care of now, we can do without the lawyer. And that is a huge problem around the country, where kids feel pressure for whether it's calendar expediency, whether it's the idea that we need to get you into services and fix the problems that you have, or whether it's pressure from parents to say, like, I can't take any more work off. I can't afford a lawyer. I don't want to go through this process. Let's get it over with today. And the social science and developmental science has taught us that, you know, kids are susceptible to pressure from adults and will want to please adults in many ways. And so in lots of circumstances, kids go along to get along kind of thing. And this is a huge problem, but the consequences of these decisions to take pleas without any understanding of what the consequences are grave. I mean, a plea to a minor misdemeanor could put the child's public housing at risk. There could be immigration consequences. There are education funding questions. If you have a drug conviction, in some situations you can't get loans. Employment, and if you have a conviction from a juvenile court, you may not be able to get jobs down the road. Sex offense registries, all hosts of different things that kids don't think about, and their families, frankly, don't think about, are the job of the lawyer to help advise them on. And when kids waive counsel, whether acquiescing or overtly, that's a problem. And so the idea behind limiting waiver of counsel is to make sure that kids talk to lawyers first before they make some of these critical decisions. And there's different ways that courts have done it. There's the Ohio Rule 3, like you explained, where the basics are kids can't waive in certain situations, in my understanding of Ohio Rule 3, if it's a transfer situation or if it's a what they call a youthful offender case, kids can't waive the right to counsel. And then if they're charged with a felony, kids can only waive the right to counsel after they've had a meaningful consultation with a defense attorney.
Correct. And there's also this one other area that I think interesting for states to know about is that they can't waive if there's a conflict or disagreement between the child and parent or guardian or custodian, or if there was a request from the parent, guardian, or custodian that the child be removed from the home.
Absolutely, because as I spoke about the financial conflict, there is a problem of when, say, for example, the parent is accusing the child of assaulting them, and then so there's an inherent conflict, and if the parent is responsible for retaining counsel for that child, that's a problem.
Right.
And National Juvenile Defender Center, as an organization, has a stance on waiver of counsel, and our stance is that there should be a presumption against waiver of counsel for children. And so that presumption against waiver is that kids should be given counsel, and it should be presumed that they're not going to waive until and unless they have meaningful consultation with a defense attorney. If after a meaningful consultation with the child, and I think being meaningful is not a two-minute conversation inside of a courtroom. It's sitting down with a child at length and having a discussion of the child's rights and the circumstances of the case. If after that the child is insisting on not having an attorney, then going before the court and the court finding on the record that this waiver of right is knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, and that's the constitutional standard for any waiver of right, that the child knowing, voluntary, and intelligently giving up his or her rights. Only in those circumstances should waiver be allowed. Now, there are other approaches and other advocates for complete bans on waiver of children. our position is the presumption against waiver is the protection that needs to be, and we don't want to disempower children. If a child wants to fire his lawyer, we can't say the child is incapable of making those choices. But the idea behind the presumption is that the child is counseled of all the consequences that may result of that.
Right. Now, I want to remind our listeners that if they would like to ask Tim or Arthur a question, you can call 347-994-1149, and you will press the number 1 on your telephone keypad, and Jillian will screen you, or feel free to pose a question in our chat room. Arthur, I don't know if you had anything you wanted to add to the waiver of counsel.
Well, California, we typically, there's a presumption of indigency for children, and they automatically appoint counsel at the outset once the child's brought into to court. And in our jurisdiction, we get appointed actually the morning of the arraignment or the morning of the detention hearing, and which gives us time to go and talk to the child before the afternoon arraignments or detention hearing. So we pretty much don't experience that problem in California, but it's kind of interesting to note. I was sitting here thinking about it. We just recently had a case that actually came out that almost got close to talking about waiver of counsel out here. We had a situation where we have a rule of court in California that says that counsel has to agree to any admission to an offense. So we have to join in the waivers, and we have to say, yes, we agree that the child should admit this offense or the child's admission. And we had a lawyer just happened to be out of Sacramento County who disagreed with the plea. And said that she didn't believe that there was a factual basis for the plea. The kid said, "I want to plea," and so the court said, "Well, I can't take your plea over your counsel's objection." Well, the appellate court came back and said, "Well, wait a minute. Yes, you can. The child essentially had a right to disagree with the attorney, fire the attorney, but they had to engage with the kid." Basically, exactly what Tim said, that it was a non-intelligent voluntary waiver that, and talk with the kid to determine whether or not there was a factual basis for the plea. And once the court was satisfied with those things, the kid could essentially disagree with his counsel, waive counsel, fire counsel, waive the rule, and enter the admission. So we've been fortunate here that from the outset anyway, the law pretty much provides that counsel should be appointed to a child if you can't afford one. And we presume most children, well, in fact, the presumption is that children are indigent. Now, one of the things that we have had some sort of battles with the court in various jurisdictions as to whether or not that counsel is also counsel for the parent. And the law seems to suggest out here that if the parent wants counsel, they have to provide their own. The court doesn't have to appoint counsel to the parent because there's, as Tim kind of mentioned, in a lot of cases there's this inherent conflict between the parent and the child. It's the child's case, and the outcomes are unique to the child, not to necessarily to the family.
Yeah, I think Arthur raises two important points that I don't think can be overstated enough. One is that the issue of waiver is closely linked to the issue of indigency, and the second is the difference between representing a parent and a child. The first, the indigency situation, is that while in some states like California there may be a presumption of indigence of children, that's not true in every state. In lots of states will look to a parent's income, not to child's. I mean, the idea behind a presumption for indigence of all children is that children in their capacity as children do not make money and do not have the resources to engage counsel. But a lot of states have found that to be impractical and expensive, and so if family has the resources, then they're going to look at the family's resources to decide whether a child has a right to counsel. But then that gets to that whole issue of financial pressure that a child may feel that I was talking about earlier, that there may be a pressure on the child overtly or subtly to get this over with and not waste the family's resources on a lawyer. And that inherent conflict makes the choice of waiving counsel not really voluntary. And so the idea behind a presumption of innocence for all children is, I think, a very good one. The second thing that Arthur got to is something we really should discuss is when we talk about defense attorneys for children, that's what they are. They are the defense attorney for the child, not for the family, not for the parents. It's just like in an adult situation where your defense attorney works for you and works for your stated interests. And I think that's an important thing to remember, and it's not something that we're seeing all across the country, that a juvenile defender who represents a child represents that child, not what's best for that child, but what that child's goals and desires are in the case. And lots of people in various roles don't necessarily get or agree with that, but courts throughout the country have said, no, the child needs an advocate for his or her interests as they see them. The court, the judge, the prosecutor, all the other people involved are looking out for what they think is the best for the child. But the defender's role is to represent the client's stated interest and to have a client-centered form of representation. So that means confidentiality towards the client, not sharing things with people, including parents, if necessary, the child is not agreeing to sharing those things. And to learn, it creates a new level of complication to the representation of children, where you have all these interested actors, parents, teachers, social workers, everyone who's involved in a child's life, and maybe saying that they're all working towards a child's best interest, but you as the defender of the child have responsibility solely to the child. And representing their stated interests. And I think that's one complication in people not understanding the role of a defense counsel.
And I will say, when I used to be in juvenile court a long time ago, those were even the messages that I would say that the attorneys themselves received, because there's sometimes this pressure for that collaborative approach. Mm-hmm. That attorneys often lose sight that their role is representation, and that time, you know, there's that zealous representation. I really want you to talk about what that entails, what that looks like, what is the role of an attorney, as well as I know the Illinois Supreme Court decision's really important. I don't know if you wanted to mention that, because there's an issue of a dual role of attorneys being appointed in delinquency cases.
Yeah, the case you're talking about in Illinois is In re Austin M, or In the Interest of Austin M. And mm-hmm. the case in that situation, the Supreme Court of Illinois said that it's kind of what I was saying before, that a defense attorney must act in the stated interest of their client, and that the child is entitled to an advocate of the child's interest. In that case, the attorney was what happens a lot is guardians ad litem, GALs. There is, in the neglect system or the abuse system, children are offered assigned attorneys that are there to represent the child's best interest. And in the delinquency system, there can be guardians ad litem as well, but they are not advocates for the child's stated interest. They are advocates for the child's best interest and helping the court decide what is best for a child. But often, as was happening in many states, but was happening in Illinois as well, is that a guardian ad litem would be wearing two hats, one as defense attorney and one as the guardian ad litem. And if the child's best interests were not in line with their stated interests, the best interests representation was trumping. And the Supreme Court of Illinois said that's just untenable. It's an inherent conflict. And that if you are going to represent a child as a juvenile defender, that's all you can do is represent their stated interests. And you cannot represent their best interests if they're in conflict with their stated interests. Mm-hmm. And the first time that the Supreme Court of Illinois made that absolutely clear, when court rules and statutes across the state were allowing this kind of thing, and judges were appointing attorneys to play both roles.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I do want to talk about sort of what we think are some standards of practice around attorney consultation, roles, and we're using the language defenders, but I also want to clarify that we don't only mean public defenders. We mean any attorney that is representing a child, whether privately obtained or through a court appointment. So the National Juvenile Defender Center has some standards coming out. Is that correct, Tim?
That's correct. Yeah, they should be released towards the end of next week, the following week. It's a project that's been over 5 years in the works, and it's a set of comprehensive national standards that provide kind of a vision of the role of juvenile defense counsel throughout the duration of a child's involvement with the delinquency system. And the idea is it's anchored in and consistent with current laws, professional codes of conduct, developmental science, and it's intended to develop and strengthen and clarify juvenile defense practice and policy. And so a lot of times we have these debates on what is your role as a juvenile defense attorney, and the debate is there is because there's a lack of clarity in some jurisdictions, or there's some conflicting ideas. And so we're coming out with a comprehensive set from the very initial stages of involvement in the juvenile justice system to post disposition. What is the role of a juvenile defense attorney vis-a-vis the system, vis-a-vis his client or his or her client? And it basically articulates a set of practice standards that every defender can look to and make sure that when they have some support for when they're trying to say to a judge, "Your Honor, I cannot answer that question because it would violate my attorney-client privilege or whatnot." Not only do they have their local codes of ethics and their local case law, but now there is a kind of a national standard for people to look at. And so, go ahead.
No, I was just going to add, you know, we've been talking about waiver of counsel. There's probably only, in my mind, only one thing worse than waiver of counsel, and it's inadequate counsel. Because the fact that kids get lawyers or anybody gets a lawyer, there's this built-in sense of a security that the lawyer is going to do everything in his or her power to represent you in court. And that's just not the case. And Tim's right. There's this big debate throughout the jurisdictions as to, you know, whether or not we should have standards of practice. There's almost a presumption that there are some standards because we all have the professional codes of professional responsibility in our various jurisdictions that talks about representing clients in criminal cases. And we all, for the most part, may have some suggestions from our various judicial counsels that talks about standards of practice. In California, we have a statement from the judicial counsel representing indigent clients in criminal and juvenile settings. And we also have a pamphlet that was released by administrative offices of the court that talks about effective representation of children in delinquency court. However, all of that comes with the sort of disclaimer, these are not hard and fast rules that are legislatively mandated that you absolutely have to follow in your jurisdiction. These are just guidelines. And you know, all good policy is only good policy until you actually implement it on the ground. One of the things we did in California last year was we introduced a bill in our state Senate to establish the minimum standards and training requirements and requirements that you would have to meet before you could actually start representing children in delinquency court. We have a similar statute in dependency court sort of as a throwaway. We have a similar statute regarding representing death penalty clients that there's these minimum standards that you have to have before you represent these types of clients. So we thought, well, let's try to get some type of a minimum standard that's been legislatively mandated where the various the public defender's offices, it's also included private counsel, whoever was representing a child in delinquency court had to have minimal education, minimal training, minimal types of things that they had to do. And we got the bill out of our Senate Public Safety Committee, but it died in our Appropriations Committee. It is just so difficult to get the jurisdictions to commit to a minimum standard of practice. And unfortunately, with respect to criminal cases, our Supreme Court's standard for ineffective assistance of counsel is very low. I mean, you'd have to show that the client that the lawyer was deficient in some way and that because of those deficiencies, the client was prejudiced. And that's just such a tough hurdle to get over, because you pretty much have to show, but for the deficiency of the attorney, the client would have won whatever winning means in a particular context. So it's really hard to try to get the jurisdictions to invest in ensuring that the lawyers are meeting these minimal standards. And that's sort of where I see a lot of the difficulty is to try to get them to the implementation of it, of it all.
And I think that's part of the problem is a lot of things are based on minimum standards and minimum requirements, and that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about standards that get to what you said, Lauren. What does zealous and competent representation look like? Just because you're not ineffective does not mean you're being competent.
Right. Right.
What does competent, zealous, diligent representation of children look like? And we keep going back to it, but I think it's important to say representation of children. It's a specialized practice.
Right.
It's not something that every lawyer can do, and it's not something that every criminal lawyer can do. The idea that the practice of defending children is like the practice of capital defense and is like appellate practice. They have specialized needs, training requirements that lawyers need to be in tune to. You know, the way you counsel a child who in an age and developmentally appropriate terms, the way you have you interact with the various systems in a juvenile court, from education and social work and the multitude of service providers and people involved is completely different than in most adult situations. And so if we're not looking at a specialized practice of standards for juvenile defenders, then we're not hitting the mark. I mean, there are codes of professional conduct out there that generally are just for general lawyers or general defense attorneys, and what we're talking about is a specialized practice with children.
So what are some strategies that, I don't want to necessarily leave if you want to talk more about what some of the standards are to get people an idea, but what are some of these, you hear all the time, well, lack of resources. First, we don't have money to appoint attorneys, that's why we don't mind the waiver of counsel. We don't have money to pay this much for attorneys to take cases, so we don't value it. You know, this is training ground for attorneys. Is the Public Defender's Juvenile Division. We don't have money for just general training. And Arthur, clearly you've been very successful at building a competent staff. So what are some suggestions? How do we change, first of all, I think the mentality, that's a much larger question about value. But, you know, what have jurisdictions done to ensure that children are getting competent representation?
One of the things we did here is when I went out to our juvenile division, what struck me was how young the children were coming into the system. And when I had practiced juvenile law, it was a training ground for our office when I first started in our office in the early 90s, and the kids seemed much older. You're talking usually about anywhere from 13 to, you know, 17-year-old children. Occasional 12-year-old might show up. But when I came back in 2003, we were seeing 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, and it just struck me as odd that you had these little children. And so I'm trying to talk, you know, I'm a 40-year-old man at that point, trying to talk to an 8-year-old and explain what's going on. And, you know, it just struck me as odd that we were shepherding these children through this criminal system at so young. And so what I did was went back to my manager and said, hey, look, you know, this is a whole new landscape, and we need people out here that's going to commit to being out here, and we have to learn all this stuff. But at the same time, I got connected, and maybe this is a plug for NJDC, but I got connected with the folks at the National Juvenile Defender Center and began to see the whole idea of the uniqueness of representing children, and that it was different, and it was a totally different practice than what my general criminal practice was when I was downtown. And I think the message is, at least in, you know, I can speak to public defender systems more than I can anything else, because this is pretty much all I've done, is to try to convince the managers or trying to show the managers that it is a different practice, that it does require a different skill set, that it does require long-term commitment. And I think, you know, in a lot of cases, the managers kind of get that. The difficulty is when you're dealing with these, especially public defender systems, is how to quantify that when you're comparing it to what's happening with the adult criminal cases in terms of career opportunity. So you're going to have to balance out that too. But it's a tough sale, but you have to be committed to it. You have to understand it. And as Tim is absolutely correct when he says that you have to look at it from the perspective that it is a specialized practice, and convince these managers that this is an investment that's going to have to make in their offices.
Tim, how about convincing the courts? Is there some sort of duty of the judge's part to ensure that the attorneys being appointed are qualified and competent?
Well, I mean, I think it's difficult. Some judges will say yes and some judges will say no. I mean, because you do have the balance of powers and issues, you know.
And just to speak to that real quick too, Tim, that was one of the problems that we had when we were trying to get the bill through California to set the standard or try to set up some standards of practice from the legislature, was the courts balked on the idea that they would participate in that process. They do actually do that in our dependency courts. The court is responsible for ensuring that the lawyers that practice in dependency court meet those particular standards and that they're meeting their training requirements annually to stay up on the practice. But we got kickback from the courts here when we tried to do it for delinquency cases. And that might just be an inherent conflict that they don't really want all this litigation going on in their courts, because that's what happened when we got more specialized here in Sacramento, that there was a real pushback because you begin to increase litigation in the cases as you became more specialized in what you were doing.
I mean, I think that's true. It's one of those self-fulfilling prophecies. You get better attorneys, you get better representation. And unfortunately, the truth is not everyone appreciates better representation. It slows the system down, and it is considered an obstacle to providing services. Because the idea, the mindset in a lot of places is that child's in the system, we need to fix what's wrong with the child. And there's very little thought given to the fact that maybe the child didn't do this. Maybe the child isn't in need of fixing yet. So let's go through the process and figure that out. And that takes time. But I think it's also, there are judges out there that are not afraid, we've seen it left every day, to say, I'm removing you from, especially when they're court appointed for indigent cases, where I'm removing you from this case and appointing someone else if they don't feel that a lawyer is up to snuff, because lots of judges too don't want their cases overturned on ineffective assistance counsel. But that's a personal thing. You can't. It's not a system wide thing, and it is not something that's even easily enforceable. Judges act independently of each other, and so the idea is really to get to what you're saying is changing the mindset of everybody, and I think the idea is that there aren't the perception is that there aren't as grave consequences for defending children, and that's why they can be juvenile court can be a training ground. But the reality is that's just not true. I mean, the idea from that came behind this older version of juvenile court where everything was confidential and what happened in juvenile court stayed in juvenile court. That's just not the reality of today's laws. Kids who have juvenile adjudications, juvenile convictions, have lifelong consequences following them. I mean, there's discussions in states where the police department is putting every juvenile conviction available online so for employers to look at. And the erosion of privacy rights in juvenile court and confidentiality of records across the country has really made these consequences for kids lifelong. We're talking about sex offense registration. Yes, you might only be under the jurisdiction of the court until your 21st birthday, but you may have to register for 20 years, lifetime registration for some of these things. And so these aren't minimal consequences. And to say that a kid is not as at risk as an adult anymore is just not the system. But I think people don't understand that, and people don't look at those consequences. And it's our job just to educate all players of the system. And I think they also don't understand the idea of specialization. If I can represent an adult, I can represent a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is it's not just the communication that we've been talking about, but it's the science. There has been such tremendous development or movement in the developmental sciences over the past two decades that talk about how all the brain and cultural development of children and their ability to make choices is different than adults, and their influence of peers is different than adults, and their capacity for understanding short and long-term consequences is different than adults. And not saying that if a child murders someone, they should get off, but the understanding that science and that research and how it may mitigate or lessen the culpability of a child is absolutely essential to the defense of children, and it's not necessarily something that adult defenders have any knowledge of. And even those of us in the juvenile system that do that need continual training on the development of things, and it's our responsibility to educate the judges. But if the defense attorney doesn't know it, how can they get there?
Well, we have about 5 minutes left, so I don't know if you want to share some final thoughts, but also if we were having this discussion and, you know, 5 years from now, where do you hope, you know, where we will be at? And if there's anything that may be happening on a policy level nationally or in states that you want to highlight for our listeners, now is the time.
Okay. Go ahead, Robert.
Well, 5 to 10 years from now, what's my wish list? Well, one of the things is I think if you could get the national organizations to work with managers in whatever appointing authorities exist in various jurisdictions to understand and appreciate the differences between representing children and adults. I mean, Tim's absolutely right. There's a whole body of science out there that has to be incorporated in your practice that you just have to know off the top of your head. Again, dealing with children is totally different than dealing with adults. And every parent or adult in the world knows that in just dealing with children day to day as opposed to dealing with adults. You have to convince those folks that you are going to have to create specializations in your offices or in your practices. And again, if you have independent courts appointing independent attorneys, that they're going to have to ensure that those attorneys are equipped to deal with this problem. Because the reality is, as Tim also pointed out, the collateral consequences to a kid going through the process creates real problems down the road for these children who become adults. I mean, they don't stay children. They become adults. They can't get jobs. They can't get funding for school. They can't get housing. They can't get into the military. They can't get – I mean, there's restriction after restriction. I have an 11-year-old who may have to register as a sex offender for the rest of his natural life. He's 11. You know, so we are creating an underclass, or we're contributing to an underclass in our society, which is going to have eventually an economic impact down the road. I mean, we are seeing the impact on our budgets now, but it's going to be a real problem down the road if we continue to marshal these kids through these processes. They have to suffer the consequences down the road, all because they didn't get adequate representation when they were in the system.
And my hope for the next, I mean, it's been 45 years and we haven't lived up to the dictates of Gault and what is expected under Gault in most jurisdictions. And so my hope for the next 10 years is that we get there. I think it's a heavy lift, but it's not something that we can't do. And so that my now, how do we do that? It's going to be different in every state. There's not a one size fits all.
Right.
Solution to that, but some states have taken tremendous strides in making that happen. I think the one state that comes to mind right now to me is Massachusetts. All of those defending getting court appointments to defend juveniles in Massachusetts, whether they're part of the Council for Public Service or Public Representation in Massachusetts, their version of the public defender, or whether they're court appointed private attorneys, still are contracted through the state office and are getting training from the state office on juvenile-specific issues. And their contracts hold them to the standards that were developed by the statewide office. And so there are state standards specialized to juvenile practice that every attorney, whether you're part of the state system or just a private court-appointed lawyer, are now being held. I think that that's a great step forward in representation.
Well, thank you both so much for being here on the show. It's been excellent.
Thank you.
We do have a lot of resources posted to this show on Children Law Center's website, and I also want to encourage our listeners to go to the National Juvenile Defender Center's website, which is njdc.info. You may also want to check out the National Juvenile Justice Network, njjn.org, and the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, ncjfcj.org. Our next show will be something a bit different. The discussion will focus on Minor Differences, a newly released documentary that chronicles the 18-year journey of five men who served time as youth in a maximum security lockup for juveniles. The filmmaker and three of the subjects of the film will discuss the making of the film and its impact on their lives. So to stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here on Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight on You. And thank you, Tim and Arthur, again.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.